So across basically every culture and century, really, there's this strangely consistent narrative that kind of haunts human history.
Yeah, it really does.
Right. It's a story told by people who have basically been brought back from the absolute edge of biological failure. And the elements are like so deeply ingrained in our collective psyche that you listening right now, you already know them, even if you've never had a brush with death yourself.
Absolutely.
There's that profound, undeniable sense of departing the physical body, a sensation of rapid movement. People often describe it as traveling through this dark enclosure or a tunnel, and it culminates in this brilliant, unearthly light.
Classic tunnel of light, yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And then there's this cascading flood of intense peace. Sometimes people even report encountering distinct entities or, departed loved ones.
Right, family members,
Yeah.
yeah.
But structurally, there is almost always this distinct awareness of a border, like a threshold or a line in the sand that the person just intuitively understands, like, I cannot cross this if I intend to return to my physical body.
And we categorize all of this clinically under the umbrella of the near-death experience, or NDE.
Right.
And the uniformity of that narrative architecture is, I mean, it's what makes it one of the most enduring mysteries in the study of consciousness. Because when you look at the phenomenological reports, whether you're reading the account of a 21st century patient who was just resuscitated in a modern ICU, following a heart attack,
Right.
or if you're examining historical texts from literally hundreds of years ago, the core structural markers of the experience remain staggeringly consistent.
Which is wild.
It is wild. And as researchers, that consistency demands an explanation. Like, we naturally seek a physiological, neurobiological mechanism for why the human cortex reliably constructs this exact same subjective landscape when the biological hardware is, actively shutting down.
Right, which brings us to the central question of our deep dive today. So, what if this profoundly mystical journey isn't a glimpse into some metaphysical afterlife, but it's actually the pharmacological work of a single, highly potent molecule that the brain makes itself?
The famous molecule.
Yes, I am talking about N-dimethyltryptamine, better known as DMT, or colloquially, the spirit molecule.
Which is such an incredibly seductive hypothesis.
Seductive is the perfect word for it.
It really is. I mean, just the concept that human evolution or nature equipped our neurobiology with this specific chemical key, a key designed to facilitate this peaceful psychological transition at the very end of life.
Yeah.
It's this elegant model that theoretically ties together ancient spiritual frameworks and, modern neurochemistry.
It is elegant, and because it's so elegant, it has completely permeated popular culture as like an accepted biological fact. You see it everywhere online.
Oh, everywhere.
So our mission today is to rigorously examine that fact. We're relying on a pretty comprehensive stack of scientific literature today, prominently featuring recent meta-analyses from the OOTW Journal.
Really rigorous stuff.
Yeah. We are going to dissect the landmark 2018 Imperial College trial. We're going to parse the neurochemical data from mammalian brain studies, specifically rats, and we're going to look really closely at the actual EEG readings of the dying brain.
The electrical activity, right?
Right. The objective here is to delineate where the romantic mythology of the spirit molecule ends and where the actual honest empirical science begins. Because the honest biological reality is, frankly, far more intricate than the popular myth.
It definitely is. The empirical reality kind of shifts the narrative away from this simplistic biological trigger, and it reveals a much more profound epistemological problem.
How so?
Well, when we evaluate the DMT near-death hypothesis through the lens of strict scientific methodology, we find this quantifiable, statistically significant experiential overlap, sure,
Right.
but it exists alongside this glaring mechanistic void. So we're essentially forced to reconcile this really beautiful pharmacological hypothesis with the unforgiving constraints of human biochemistry.
Okay, so to understand how we even arrived at this intersection, we have to look at the genesis of the modern DMT narrative. Because the idea that endogenous DMT, meaning DMT made inside the body that it mediates the death experience, it didn't just organically manifest out of thin air,
No, not at all.
is a very specific origin point. Early 1990s, clinical psychiatrist Rick Strassman,
Yes.
and Strassman's work at the University of New Mexico between like 1990 and 1995 is totally foundational here because he was navigating an incredibly hostile regulatory environment at the time.
Hostile is putting it mildly.
Right. Following the Controlled Substances Act in 1970, clinical human psychedelic research in the U.S. had been effectively paralyzed for decades.
The regulatory labyrinth he had to navigate really cannot be overstated. I mean, he wasn't operating on the fringes.
Yeah.
He was conducting heavily scrutinized FDA and DEA approved phase I dose response studies in a major university hospital.
Right.
He was bringing classical psychedelics back into the realm of rigorous allopathic scientific inquiry after a 2-decade freeze.
Which is huge.
It was. And the parameters of his study were strictly controlled. They focused on intravenous administration 5E drips to bypass the variables of, you know, oral ingestion or smoking.
So they could track exactly how much was in the blood.
Exactly. Ensuring precise pharmacokinetic tracking.
So over that 5-year period, he administered roughly 400 intravenous doses of DMT to about 60 healthy human volunteers. And the qualitative data he collected from those sessions totally altered the trajectory of psychedelic research.
Completely changed the game.
Because the volunteers, they weren't reporting the classic, you know, geometric visual distortions you might expect from psilocybin or LSD.
Right, the typical trippy stuff.
Yeah, instead they were reporting being violently catapulted into these fully realized non-Euclidean spaces.
Whole other worlds.
And a recurring theme was the perception of encountering autonomous, highly intelligent entities, often described as like guides or aliens or mechanical beings inside these hyperdimensional environments.
Yeah, the entity encounters are fascinating.
So the profound ontological shock of these experiences led Strassman to coin the term spirit molecule in his 2001 publication.
And Strassman documented all these entity encounters and the overwhelming sense of passing through a veil. But he also took this crucial inferential leap.
Right. The leap that started all this.
Exactly. He synthesized his clinical observations with historical philosophy. He directed attention toward the pineal gland.
The little gland in the brain.
Right. It's a small endocrine gland situated deep in the brain's midline. Now, René Descartes famously posited the pineal gland as the principal seat of the soul.
Wow.
He thought it was a literal point where the immaterial mind interfaced with the physical body.
That's quite a pedigree for a tiny gland.
It is. And Strassman boldly, but admittedly speculatively, hypothesized that this specific gland might synthesize and release massive quantities of DMT during critical biological transitions.
Like when?
Specifically at birth, during spontaneous mystical states, and in the final moments of physiological death.
Okay, so I want to use an analogy here for you listening, because it's basically like this idea of an evolutionary eject button.
Ooh, I like that.
Right. The idea that the brain just floods you with this comforting mystical compound to ease the terrifying transition of death, it provides a very neat biological mechanism for the transition of consciousness.
It really does.
And to ground why finding a mechanism for the NDE is so critical in the medical community, we should look at the actual epidemiological data on how often this happens.
We definitely should.
Because in 2001, the medical journal The Lancet published this prospective study led by a cardiologist named Pim van Lommel. And the methodology here is key. This wasn't a retrospective survey where people self-reported mystical experiences, you know, years after the fact.
Right. Memory gets so corrupted over time.
Exactly. They proactively tracked 344 patients who had suffered cardiac arrest and were clinically dead, meaning no pulse, no respiration, essentially a flat EEG, and these patients were subsequently resuscitated.
The prospective nature of Van Lommel's study is what makes that data so incredibly robust. They interviewed these patients within days of resuscitation to minimize that memory corruption.
And the findings were just staggering. Out of those 344 clinically dead patients, approximately 18% reported experiencing a structured, lucid, near-death experience.
18%.
Nearly one in five people whose brains were suffering from severe global ischemia, meaning a total lack of oxygenated blood flow, they returned with highly organized sequential memories of transitioning out of their bodies.
See, that 18% figure, it presents a massive cognitive dissonance for modern neurology.
How so?
Well, under standard neurobiological models, an anoxic brain, a brain totally deprived of oxygen, it should not be capable of producing highly structured lucid narratives.
Right, it's suffocating.
Exactly. Hypoxia typically induces confusional states, delirium, fragmented memory, not hyperlucid, sequential, and deeply meaningful phenomenological events.
That makes sense.
The fact that the cortex is seemingly offline, yet generating the most profound conscious experience of a person's entire life, it demands a mechanism. And Strassman's hypothesis provided one. The brain isn't just dying, it is actively modifying its own neurochemistry to ease the transition.
So the hypothesis posits this evolutionary buffer. Terminal decline initiates, the pineal gland floods the cerebral cortex with endogenous DMT, transforming what should be a chaotic biological failure into a coherent transcendent journey.
Beautiful, isn't it?
It is. But I find myself wondering, why did this very specific, admittedly speculative hypothesis from 2001 book completely escape standard scientific skepticism? Like, it hardened into absolute dogma online so easily. If you look at mainstream discourse today, the idea that the brain dumps DMT at death, it's stated not as a theory, but as an established peer-reviewed fact.
Yeah, it's stated as gospel.
Right.
And we really have to view that cultural assimilation through the lens of human psychology. We possess this fundamental drive to seek out elegant, unifying theories that resolve existential dread.
Right. We want to not be terrified of dying.
Exactly. The DMT death hypothesis acts as this perfect epistemological bridge. It beautifully connects the biochemical realities of neurology with the transcendent aspects of human spirituality. It essentially provides a neurochemical warm blanket against the void of death.
A warm blanket, yeah.
And look, Strassman himself maintains scientific integrity. He explicitly framed the pineal DMT release as a speculative hypothesis, a what-if, designed to spur further clinical research.
But the internet doesn't do nuance.
No. Popular culture inevitably strips away the methodological caveats in favor of the comforting conclusion. Science requires holding beautiful ideas up to a harsh light, but the transition from hypothesis to presumed fact in the public eye bypasses the requirement for empirical testing entirely.
Which makes the transition to actual empirical testing the most fascinating part of this narrative. Because for decades, this link was purely anecdotal. You had a psychonaut describing a DMT breakthrough, and you had a cardiac arrest survivor describing an NDE, and people just thought they sounded similar.
Right, linguistic overlap.
Yeah. But how do you actually measure the unmeasurable? You know, how do you map the ineffable? It took until 2018 for a research team to design a clinical test to actually measure this resemblance.
And that 2018 trial, it was conducted by the Psychedelic Research Group at Imperial College London, led by Christopher Timmerman and Robin Carhart-Harris. It really represents a watershed moment in psychopharmacology.
What did they do differently?
Well, they understood that comparing unstructured trip reports to unstructured NDE accounts was statistically meaningless. They needed a validated psychometric instrument.
And their experimental design was elegantly straightforward, but like completely unprecedented. They recruited 13 healthy volunteers, individuals with no proximity to death, normal cardiovascular function, totally baseline neurobiology.
Just normal, healthy people.
Right. And in a randomized, placebo-controlled, single-blind study, these participants receive an IV infusion of DMT on one day and a placebo on another.
IV again for control.
Exactly. And after the acute effects subsided, the researchers didn't just ask them to describe the trip. They administered the Grayson Near-Death Experience Scale.
Now, it is essential for the listener to understand the rigor of the Grayson scale.
Please unpack this for us.
It was developed by psychiatrist Bruce Grayson in 1983. And it is not some subjective mood questionnaire. It is a rigorously validated 16-item clinical instrument utilized globally to authenticate and quantify the depth of actual, real near-death experiences.
Right.
It's divided into four subscales: cognitive, affective, paranormal, and transcendental. So it measures very specific parameters, things like the distortion of time, feelings of cosmic unity, encounters with mystical light, and the perception of extrasensory knowledge.
And how is it scored?
Each item is scored from 0 to 2, creating a maximum possible score of 32. And a score of 7 or higher is the established clinical threshold for classifying an event as a true near-death experience.
Okay, so this is where the data becomes literally arresting. When the 13 healthy volunteers were evaluated using the Grayson scale after their DMT infusions, all 13 of them, a 100% success rate, scored above the threshold of 7.
All of them.
The DMT experience didn't just casually resemble an NDE. It systematically triggered the specific psychological markers that the medical community uses to define the death experience. And when they drilled down into the data on 15 of the 16 items on that scale, the DMT scores were significantly higher than the placebo.
And the comparative analysis is what truly elevates this study. The researchers took the psychometric data from the DMT volunteers, and they cross-referenced it with a matched cohort of people who had survived actual documented physiological near-death experiences.
So comparing the trip to reality.
Exactly. Yeah. And when overlaid, the statistical profiles were nearly indistinguishable. There was no statistically significant divergence on 15 out of the 16 features. The strongest overlaps occurred within the transcendental and affective subscales. specifically the overwhelming sensation of unity with a universal consciousness, the perception of an ineffable, brilliant light, and profound feelings of joy and peace.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because if it perfectly mimics a near-death experience on a standardized medical scale with a 13 for 13 conversion rate and statistical parity on 15 out of 16 specific metrics, doesn't that essentially prove the theory? It's so easy to see why the media declared the mystery solved.
We really need to pump the brakes here, though.
Okay, pump.
Because we have to rigorously examine that 16th item.
Right, the one that didn't match.
Exactly. If 15 items match perfectly, that single point of divergence is likely the key to understanding the mechanism. We have to ask, where exactly did the DMT experience fail to map onto the biological death experience?
Okay, what was the difference?
The divergence is structurally profound. So while the emotional and transcendental aesthetics matched perfectly, the narrative architecture diverged sharply at the concept of the boundary.
The border.
Right. Individuals who undergo genuine biological NDEs almost universally report a definitive sense of arriving at a border, a physical or metaphysical point of no return.
Like a river or a door.
Exactly. It functions as the climax of their narrative arc. They reach this threshold and are either told to go back or they make a conscious choice to return to their bodies. The DMT cohort, however, largely failed to register this specific phenomenological marker.
Okay, but that structural absence actually makes perfect sense when you consider the physiological context, doesn't it? Like, the DMT volunteers are in a comfortable clinical setting.
Right.
Their cardiovascular system is operating optimally. They aren't experiencing the cascading biological feedback loop of terminal decline. The drug induces the sensory environment, sure, but the body knows it isn't actually failing, so the brain doesn't generate the psychological construct of a final threshold.
Precisely. The context of the body matters. And we also see divergence in the cognitive subscale. For example, actual NDEs frequently feature the classic life review, you know, a hyperlucid panoramic recall of your entire episodic memory, often experienced from the perspective of others.
Flashing before your eyes.
Exactly. Well, DMT infusions produce significantly less of that classic life review. Furthermore, the distinct sensation of out-of-body separation where a patient explicitly views their own biological form on an operating table, that was also less pronounced in the pharmacological model.
Okay, so this highlights why Timmerman and Carhart-Harris were so fastidious with their nomenclature. The published paper isn't titled DMT Causes the Near-Death Experience. It is specifically titled DMT Models the Near-Death Experience.
The wording is everything.
Right. And I have to challenge the utility of how people interpret that word, models, because think about it. A Category D flight simulator models catastrophic engine failure perfectly.
Hi.
Right? The pilot's heart rate spikes, cortisol floods their endocrine system, the visual and haptic feedback is indistinguishable from a real crash. But if you step out of the simulator and conclude, this proves that real-world engine failure is caused by hydraulic code, you've completely misunderstood the mechanism.
That's a great analogy.
Right. Are the researchers suggesting DMT is the underlying code or simply an incredibly accurate simulator?
That is the exact epistemological distinction the researchers are enforcing. The DMT experience is the high-fidelity simulator. It maps the terrain, it reproduces the color, it utilizes the exact same perceptual and affective neuroarchitecture, but it does not confirm the biological trigger.
It reproduces the color, but not the full narrative arc.
Exactly. A fundamental axiom of pharmacology is that phenomenological resemblance does not dictate mechanistic equivalence. Just because a serotonin 2A receptor agonist like DMT can induce cosmic unity, that does not prove that the dying cortex is actually synthesizing that specific agonist. Resemblance is not mechanism.
Which dictates our next line of inquiry. If DMT successfully models the subjective experience, the next logical question is, does the dying brain actually release it? We must search for empirical evidence of its endogenous presence during death.
Right. We have to look for the chemical itself.
For Strassman's theory to hold biological weight, the mammalian cortex must possess the enzymatic machinery to synthesize the molecule, and we have to observe a quantifiable release during the dying process.
And historically, the evidence for endogenous DMT was marginal at best. I mean, while trace amounts had been detected in human blood and cerebrospinal fluid, it was often just dismissed as a metabolic byproduct or even an artifact of dietary intake.
Like from something they ate.
Right. It wasn't until a paradigm shift in methodology, moving away from human phenomenological surveys to rigorous neurochemical assays in animal models, that we acquired concrete data.
And this directs us to the 2019 research from Dr. Jimo Borjigin's laboratory at the University of Michigan. Her team designed a study utilizing in vivo microdialysis in rat brains, which basically allowed them to sample neurochemicals in real time.
And the baseline findings alone forced a reevaluation of mammalian neurochemistry.
What did they find?
They definitively demonstrated that DMT is not only present in the living rat cortex, but it exists at nanomolar concentrations.
Okay, to contextualize nanomolar concentrations for the listener, we are not talking about microscopic, irrelevant trace amounts here. A nanomolar concentration places endogenous DMT on par with the baseline extracellular levels of classic canonical neurotransmitters like serotonin and dopamine.
Yes, it implies that DMT is not a mere metabolic anomaly. It is being actively synthesized and maintained by the brain's regulatory systems.
Wow.
Furthermore, Borjigin's team utilized in situ hybridization to confirm that the mammalian brain actively expresses the gene for INMT, which is indolethylamine and methyltransferase. That is the specific enzyme required to catalyze the final step of DMT synthesis from its precursor, tryptamine.
Okay, so the validation of the synthetic pathway is crucial. They have the machinery to make it. But the experimental design went even further. They didn't just map the baseline neurochemistry of healthy rats. They deliberately induced experimental cardiac arrest in the rats.
Right.
They were continuously monitoring the extracellular chemical environment as the cortex underwent acute global ischemia. And the microdialysis revealed that in the immediate aftermath of cardiac arrest, the endogenous DMT levels spiked significantly.
The concentrations rose sharply in the visual cortex specifically, which is a finding that immediately catalyzed speculation regarding the highly visual nature of near-death hallucinations.
Okay, here's where it gets really interesting. Because when you examine the parameters of that study, the narrative seems to just snap into place.
It's very tempting.
Right. You have a known psychedelic compound. You have proof of the enzymatic machinery required to build it. You have baseline levels comparable to standard neurotransmitters. And you have empirical data showing a sudden, significant surge in the visual cortex precisely at the onset of biological death.
It looks perfect on paper.
I gotta play the believer here. The temptation to label this the definitive smoking gun is overwhelming. If it surges in a rat's brain after cardiac arrest, isn't that the smoking gun we were looking for? How does this data not validate the hypothesis?
The data is profoundly significant, I will grant you that. But we must apply rigorous scientific caution and pharmacological scrutiny to what a surge actually signifies in this context.
Okay, deflate my balloon.
Well, let's use the researcher's own careful words. Dr. Borjigin and her team maintain strict scientific objectivity. While the relative concentration of DMT rose significantly compared to the pre-arrest baseline, the absolute quantifiable levels remain the critical unknown.
Meaning what, exactly?
Meaning it is entirely unknown if those concentrations in rats are anywhere near enough to produce a psychedelic effect. We do not currently have the data to determine if that ischemic surge crosses the necessary pharmacological threshold to induce a high-level hallucination.
Ah, so the presence of a chemical doesn't guarantee the activation of a macro-level conscious experience.
Exactly. Psychedelic effects are contingent upon receptor-binding affinities, primarily those 5-HT2A serotonin receptors. A specific percentage of these receptors must be occupied by the molecule to trigger the cascading network changes associated with a breakthrough experience.
Right.
We have an empirically measured surge, yes. But we are entirely ignorant as to whether that absolute volume of DMT is sufficient to dominate the receptor sites, especially in a dying brain that is simultaneously being flooded with a chaotic storm of other neurotransmitters.
And we also run into the inherent limitations of translational science here, don't we? The data is derived from the rodent cortex.
Yes, rats are not humans.
The cytoarchitecture, the receptor density, and the overall metabolic volume of the human brain are vastly different. Extrapolating a microdialysis spike in a 300-gram rat into a systemic hallucinogenic flood in a dying human being, that requires a massive, currently unsupported inferential leap.
A huge leap. And it is completely unknown if this surge happens in human brains at all.
Because we simply cannot ethically or practically insert microdialysis probes into the visual cortex of a human patient during a heart attack to verify the correlation.
Exactly. We are operating in a space of informed extrapolation. A measurable chemical rise in a rat is leaps and bounds away from a brain-flooding psychedelic event in a dying human. The Borjigin study is a masterpiece of neurochemical mapping. It validates that the mammalian brain can and does synthesize DMT and that stress alters its concentration. But it does not definitively prove that this mechanism is the primary architect of the human near-death experience.
Which is fascinating. But interestingly, while the 2019 rat study provided the strongest circumstantial evidence for endogenous DMT, it simultaneously did something else. It quietly obliterated the most romanticized famous element of the mythos.
Oh, yes. The pineal gland.
It dismantled the role of the pineal gland. If we return to Strassman's original speculation, the idea that the pineal gland is this localized epicenter, this third eye that ruptures at death to flood the brain with the spirit molecule, we really have to confront the biological arithmetic. Let's do the math on the myth.
I love doing the math on this. The dismantling of the pineal flood theory requires a strict examination of enzyme kinetics and biological mass. And pharmacologist David Nichols executed this brilliantly in his 2018 analysis.
What did he find?
Well, Nichols possesses unparalleled expertise in psychedelic chemistry, and he essentially audited the pineal gland's capacity for biosynthesis. First of all, the human pineal gland is diminutive. It possesses a mass of roughly 150 milligrams.
Tiny.
Very tiny. And its primary evolutionary function is the synthesis of melatonin from serotonin to regulate our circadian rhythms, sleep cycles.
Right. So Nichols analyzed the biological output, noting that the tiny pineal gland synthesizes only about 30 micrograms of melatonin over a 24-hour cycle. Micrograms, yes. But to achieve the profound phenomenological states reported in the Imperial College study, the entity encounters, the ego dissolution, a human, requires a pharmacological dose of DMT in the magnitude of 25 milligrams.
The mathematical disparity there is just irreconcilable. 25 milligrams represents a mass roughly 1,000 times greater than the total daily biosynthetic output of the pineal gland.
1,000 times.
Yes. To validate the pineal flood hypothesis, you're demanding that a 150 milligram gland instantly upregulate its enzymatic machinery to manufacture a massive quantity of a secondary compound in a matter of seconds.
While the body is dying.
Precisely as the body's ATP, the cellular energy currency, is rapidly depleting due to lack of oxygen.
So thinking about this, saying the pineal gland floods the brain with DMT is like saying you can fill an Olympic swimming pool in 3 seconds using a single eyedropper.
That is a perfect analogy, yes. And the synthetic limitation is really only half the problem, isn't it?
Right, because even if the pineal gland possesses some theoretical, you know, latent reservoir of DMT, it faces an incredibly hostile environment upon release.
It faces a highly efficient metabolic degradation system. The human biological system is saturated with monoamine oxidase, specifically MAOA.
Right.
This is an enzyme whose primary evolutionary function is the rapid destruction of monoamines, including tryptamines like DMT. This is exactly why oral DMT is not psychoactive, unless you co-administer it with an MAO inhibitor, like they do in ayahuasca.
Otherwise, your stomach just destroys it.
Exactly. And in the brain, endogenous DMT is metabolized with extraordinary speed. It would have to survive the brain's enzymes that normally destroy DMT instantly.
So the prevailing internet theory requires a microscopic gland to instantaneously synthesize a chemical payload 1,000 times greater than its daily capacity, utilizing failing cellular energy, and somehow bypass the brain's aggressive, naturally occurring enzymatic defense mechanisms, all within the span of a few seconds.
Nichols summarized it with terminal precision. He said it is simply impossible for the pineal gland to accomplish such a heroic biochemical feat.
The math precludes the myth.
It does. Even Strassman himself found no DMT in human pineal glands later on. And to secure the final nail in the coffin, when Dr. Borjigin's team conducted their 2019 microdialysis study, they also tested rats that had been pineolectomized.
Meaning their pineal glands had been surgically removed.
Right. And the brains of those rats continued to synthesize endogenous DMT at normal baseline levels. The production of the molecule is not dependent on the pineal gland. It's distributed across the cortex, not isolated within the seat of the soul.
Okay, that constitutes a monumental paradigm shift for the listener. While DMT is made elsewhere in the brain, the romantic, aesthetically pleasing cinematic image of the third eye, unleashing a torrent of the spirit molecule at death, that has to be retired.
The truth is much more subtle.
But this leaves us with a gaping mechanistic void, because the phenomenology is undeniably real. Almost 20% of cardiac arrest survivors are having hyperlucid experiences. If a heroic pharmacological flood of DMT isn't orchestrating the narrative, then what is happening in the brain at the moment of death to cause such vivid experiences?
To answer that, we must pivot our focus from neurochemistry to neurophysiology. The dying brain doesn't need DMT to put on a show. We have to look at the electrical behavior of the cortex under acute terminal stress.
The electrical fireworks.
Exactly. We conceptually frame death as a cessation, right? A slow dimming of the biological lights. But the empirical data reveals that the dying brain does not simply power down. It initiates a spectacular electrical phenomenon.
And we return to Dr. Borjigin's laboratory for this discovery as well, which actually predates their neurochemical work. In 2013, her team conducted a landmark EEG study on rats undergoing cardiac arrest. They were mapping the real-time electrical oscillations of the cortex as the heart stopped and oxygen delivery failed.
Standard medical intuition suggests that anoxic depolarization, basically the failure of ion channels due to lack of oxygen, that should result in a rapid, uniform flattening of the EEG.
A flat line.
Right. But that is not what they observed. In the initial 30 seconds immediately following cardiac arrest, prior to the onset of the flat line, they recorded a massive, transient surge of highly synchronized gamma wave activity.
Okay, we need to unpack the significance of gamma waves for the listener, because understanding this frequency band is critical to understanding the mechanism of consciousness here. The brain operates across various oscillatory frequencies, right? You have slow delta waves during deep sleep, theta waves during REM, alpha waves when awake but relaxed.
Right, but gamma oscillations occur at the highest frequency band, typically between 40 and 100 hertz. And gamma coherence is considered the primary neural correlate of higher order consciousness.
So, complex thought.
Yes. It is the frequency associated with hyperfocus, deep cognitive processing, and memory retrieval. More importantly, gamma waves are theoretically responsible for resolving the binding problem in neuroscience.
Which is what?
It's the mechanism by which the brain synchronizes disparately processed sensory information into a single, unified, coherent conscious experience. When you experience a moment of profound insight, or you are deeply engaged in complex problem solving, your cortex exhibits synchronized gamma activity.
So within 30 seconds of the heart stopping, as the tissue is actively suffocating, the rat cortex doesn't drift into unconsciousness. It explodes into the exact electrical frequency associated with conscious information processing.
It is a paradoxical hyperarousal. The absolute power of the gamma oscillations during that 30-second window actually exceeded the levels recorded during the rat's healthy baseline waking state.
Wait, really?
Yes. The dying brain was, from an electrophysiological standpoint, operating at a level of conscious intensity greater than normal waking life.
Wow. But again, the translational gap exists, right? A gamma surge in a rodent cortex under laboratory conditions doesn't inherently prove that human brains exhibit the same hyperarousal during biological death. We lacked the human echo for a decade.
We lacked it until 2023. When a collaborative research team, which actually included Dr. Borjigin, published a groundbreaking study led by Dr. Gang Zhu.
What did they do?
They secured the opportunity to continuously monitor the EEGs of four comatose human patients in a neurointensive care unit as they were being compassionately withdrawn from life support.
Oh, wow.
And as these patients transitioned through the dying process following the removal of life support, the researchers identified the human corollary to the rat data.
Right, because as the oxygen levels plummeted, two out of those four patients demonstrated a striking transient surge in high-frequency gamma activity and connectivity just as they died.
Exactly. Furthermore, this electrical surge wasn't localized. It demonstrated increased functional connectivity across multiple cortical domains.
I want to pose a philosophical but scientifically grounded question to you as a listener here. We always imagine death as a fading out, like a TV screen powering down. But this suggests it's more like a fireworks finale. Why would the brain increase conscious processing, burning through its final energy reserves in a massive gamma storm as it runs out of oxygen?
A great question, and it requires contextualizing what's happening. The dying brain isn't just peacefully switching off. It is in crisis mode.
Right.
It is fiercely fighting for survival. The sudden cessation of oxygen triggers a massive biological alarm. The subsequent gamma surge likely represents a desperate, last-ditch survival mechanism, the cortex dumping every available reserve of excitatory neurotransmitters in a chaotic attempt to restart the heart or awaken the organism.
So the NDE might simply be the felt internal signature of this extreme, last-ditch electrical storm. No exotic molecules required.
Exactly. Because external sensory input has failed. The brain turns its processing power entirely inward, rapidly synthesizing stored memories and emotional valences. The intense light, the panoramic life review, they don't require DMT. It might just be the subjective interpretation of a dying cortex detonating its final electrical reserves.
But wait, if DMT is just one theory, and the gamma storm is this underlying mechanism. Are there other chemicals or processes that mimic the NDE just as well, if not better? Because when a complex biological system like the human brain begins to fail, it fails across multiple vectors simultaneously.
It definitely does. The field of rival suspects is vast. When we analyze the neurobiology of dying, we are examining a chaotic cascade. DMT is merely one potential variable. Let's systematically evaluate the other primary candidates, starting with elevated carbon dioxide. Hypercapnia, or abnormally elevated CO2 in the blood, is a direct consequence of respiratory failure. And clinical studies analyzing cardiac arrest survivors have linked elevated CO2 to more intense near-death experiences. Elevated CO2 directly impacts neuronal excitability and can independently trigger profound visual hallucinations.
So just the simple act of cellular suffocation constructs portions of the narrative. What about the feeling of leaving the physical body?
That can be mapped to specific cortical geography, primarily the temporoparietal junction, or TPJ.
Right.
When neuroscientists apply focal electrical stimulation to the TPJ in clinical settings, they reliably and repeatedly trigger profound out-of-body experiences in labs. The patient's spatial map desynchronizes, resulting in the vivid sensation of floating above the operating table.
Which maps perfectly onto the NDE survivor reports, the TPJ misfires, and the body schema fractures. And what about the concept of entering a distinct, separate reality?
The neuroarchitecture of sleep provides another mechanism. Research indicates that intrusions of REM sleep machinery into waking consciousness are statistically common in NDE reporters. Under the extreme stress of dying, the brainstem may inadvertently deploy its deeply entrenched dream architecture.
The brain is frantically searching for a response to stress, and it accidentally opens the file for lucid dreaming.
Exactly.
But there's one chemical suspect that rivals, and in some models exceeds, DMT. We need to introduce the strongest chemical rival, ketamine.
Ketamine introduces an entirely different pharmacological mechanism. It's a dissociative anesthetic that blocks NMDA receptors.
Let's break down that mechanism for the listener. What does blocking the NMDA receptor actually do?
When ketamine blocks the NMDA receptors, it severs the transmission of sensory data from the body to the brain. But it simultaneously causes a paradoxical disinhibition, leading to a massive secondary surge of glutamate. The result is profound physical dissociation coupled with intense internal cerebral hyperarousal.
It perfectly mimics the sensory deprivation and internal lucidity of death.
Exactly. Psychiatrist Carl Janssen proposed the ketamine model back in 1997. He demonstrated that ketamine produces states that people rate as more semantically similar to real near-death experiences than almost any other drug, including DMT.
Wow. So what does this all mean for the listener? We have DMT, ketamine, CO2, electrical storms, sleep intrusions.
It means we have to connect the dots.
Right.
The NDE is almost certainly an emergent phenomenon.
Right.
It's not the unique fingerprint of one single molecule. It's the mind's desperate response to a brain under extreme stress. It's an entire chorus of neurotransmitters, oxygen deprivation, and the architecture of consciousness itself fracturing. DMT might just be one voice in that chorus.
That conclusion is profoundly humbling. It strips away the neat simplicity of the spirit molecule myth. But wait, even if DMT isn't the sole cause of the NDE, I don't want the listener feeling like the DMT connection is trivial.
Oh, it's not trivial at all.
Right. Because we have to circle back to the Timmerman and Imperial College study. Why is their finding that DMT models the NDE such a massive tilt to science?
Because it provides a safe, controllable, reproducible model of one of the most profound experiences a human being can have.
Right.
Researchers can study the emotional texture, the neuroscience, and crucially, the NDE's capacity to reduce the fear of death via a 15-minute lab infusion without anyone actually having to nearly die.
Which is incredible. Think about it. Whether you're nearing the end of your life or sitting in a lab chair, the fact that we all carry the biological hardware to access this exact same landscape is just incredible.
It really is. It suggests the NDE is not an alien intrusion or a glitch. It is an experience latent in the ordinary human brain, a capacity we all carry around with us, just waiting.
So as we summarize the honest bottom line for you today, the resemblance between DMT trips and NDEs is real, measurable, and stunning. But the scientific proof stops there.
It does.
The human brain hasn't been shown to flood with it at death. The pineal gland math is just impossible, and the brain has its own dramatic electrical fireworks.
Mm-hmm.
The resemblance is a beautiful clue, not a conclusion.
Wonder-filled, but scientifically careful.
Exactly. Which leaves you with a final, provocative thought to mull over. If the near-death experience is a latent, universal capacity of the human brain, like a hidden room we all have inside us, and it can be unlocked by multiple different keys, like a DMT infusion, a dose of ketamine, or the biological stress of fading oxygen, what does that say about the true purpose of that room? Why did nature build an architecture for such profound peace right at the very edge of the end?